Okay, we have a quorum of us. So do we have approval of the agenda as written and hopefully in front of you?
I move we approve the agenda.
One move and, well, two moves, which I will count as a move in a second. So any opposition to approving the agenda? Agenda is approved. I would now open up to public comment, except that we have no members of the public, so I imagine this will be a very short session. Did anybody submit anything in writing in advance?
No.
All right, then. Public comment period closed. So we will be having Christian Dorsey join us in a bit, and he will be giving us an update on the RAC operational review. But before we do that, I'm sure that everybody read with great interest the recommendations that we provided to the board so far. But I will have this side of the room, which is the side that authored the report, given that they all decided to sit over here, just give us a summary of what it was that y'all said. We put together a trio of our subset to reply. So.
I could start. now, everyone keeps saying, and I'm going to say this again, this is all preliminary and, you know, this isn't by any means final, but these were some changes we came up with, some of our, some of the input that we had regarding communication with the board. Sitsa and Rebecca can talk more about that, but my part was how do you deal with potential decreases in the number of members? So, and how do we make the members more the members that we do have remaining more productive? We're not going to talk about decreasing the size of the RAC by any number. I think that's more of a higher level decision. But in case it happens, what one thought that I'll just say I had was. How do we keep people within the organization? And one of which was we eliminate the number of people. We eliminate the quota for having people from particular jurisdictions, local jurisdictions. Instead of saying three people from Prince George's and three people from Montgomery, one person from the city of Alexandria, that's me, just saying a certain number of people from Virginia, a certain number of people from D.C., and a certain number of people from Maryland. And Sitsa had a good idea to have more at-large members. So we don't say, there are a lot of people from D.C. that want to be a part of the organization, and they have to, they wouldn't be able to be a part of it because we're already booked up on our D.C. slots. So we would actually allow more people to be members of the RAC and not be prohibited from taking part. That was a good idea Sitsa had. One idea I had was to decrease the number of standing committees and merging two committees, which were the PPP, sorry, Joe, and the Budget Committee, and have, like, one committee that handles maybe, like I said, all preliminary, but handle bus service, or service in general, metro service, bus service, et cetera, which hasn't been a part of a subject matter committee, at least from what I've seen in the bylaws. So it would take those sort of issues when people come in and say, they're cutting my bus route, they're cutting a bus stop, whatever. They would have some place to go to bring those particular issues. The other thing I had was that according to the bylaws as they are now, every members of the RAC are encouraged, and that is the exact word, to join committees. We would want, or at least as I wrote, proposed that it would be a requirement that every person in the RAC join a committee, however that committee wants to deal with membership or what, if they are a member or not, is up to that particular committee. Obviously, there would be some exemptions, would be the leadership group and the leadership committee and the AAC. But every person who joins the RAC would be required to join a committee. That's all I had in a nutshell.
Yeah. I'll talk a little about some of the communications ideas. So the gist of this is really establishing a set of norms and principles under which both the RAC and the board can communicate better. And by communicating better, I think the idea that we all shared, and it's sort of born out of the sentiments that seem to have come from, you know, the last previous meetings and discussions that we've had. You know, knowing well in advance of time what the board is working on and voting on, being able to sort of have a clear line of communication, and whenever we send communication to them, you know, and asking a response, receiving one in due time. And so I guess going through some of the more specific proposals, this sort of number one, this sort of 30-day rule, requiring that whenever the RAC sends a letter, a memo, or any sort of proposal or communication to the board, and we request a response, you know, 30 days should kind of be the expected time frame under which, you know, we receive some sort of substantive communication. It doesn't mean that the board has to agree with us. It doesn't mean that whatever proposal we make goes into effect immediately. It's just a response saying, hey, thank you for your communication. We've read it, and here are our responses. Here's what we think. The other big one that I feel personally pretty passionate about is this idea that whenever the board knows that they're voting on something that is rider-facing, that could be fair and budget initiatives, budget changes, service disruptions, programs that affect riders, any sort of big formal vote that's not any, you know, tied to an emergency, really should come before the RAC, and they really should be giving us an opportunity to offer input. We didn't specify exactly, you know, what counts as emergency, what's not, and what counts as rider-facing. I think that's something that we can leave to the discretion of the board. And we also didn't specify what a reasonable time frame is. I think, you know, that's something the board can think about and come back to us with. But I think that's sort of pretty reasonable, you know, giving them some sort of set time frame. Maybe it's, you know, 2 weeks, just as a heads up and saying, we're going to be voting on this. You know, could you please offer us your input? I think that's pretty reasonable. And then some smaller ideas, I think better aligning RAC committee work, sharing agendas and minutes in full, and that I think goes both for us as well as the board, so whatever we work on and our minutes and our committee work. Typically that's been a little opaque, I think, to the board. They don't really know our work plans. And so sending that to them on a regular basis, you know, saying here's what we discussed in committee, here's the agenda for our next meeting, sending it to them, and then also expecting them to do the same for us. And then finally, I think just to encourage better communication, for example, encouraging that all of our emails are known to all of the board members and all of the board's members' emails are known to all of us, so that, you know, we are able to, let's say we have a question about something that a board member's proposer is working on, individual members are empowered to email that board member and say, either can we meet and discuss this, can we have a phone call, or what do you think about the proposal that we sent you? I think creating opportunities for some of that more informal channels of communication can sort of really help align the board and the RAC better. So with that, I'll defer to Rebecca if you want to talk about some of your work and your proposals.
Yeah, we talked also about work plans, and I think one of the things that can help us feel more empowered and more able to make a stronger outreach plan to actual riders and engaging with more riders, since not a lot of riders come to this meeting, but we want to engage more with riders, really kind of fleshing out and defining what we want to work on, what the board or staff think that they can propose to us that we would be looking at throughout the year, and then finalizing a work plan that will be sort of board approved and sanctioned that will then allow us to sort of divvy up special issues like bus route, or sporting events, or, you know, racial profiling, or whatever it is. We can put those issues into the work plan, get some buy-in that the board is acknowledging that we're going to work on those issues, then divvy them up into the subject matter committees, which may not be forward-looking, like, oh, okay, the customer service is going to work against racial profiling. Well, maybe it's going to be, you know, something that we know we're working on, and then we put out communications to riders and rider stakeholder groups. And so, I mean, there's some specific ideas about what, you know, what we would be working on, and then using sort of like pre-existing laws or protections or resources to push through some of our recommendations and sort of predetermined areas that we're going to look to. Because there are already, we talked about this in our little chats and conversations, that there are already like pre-existing protections, and I think that's one of the reasons that the AAC has such broad support and maybe, you know, enjoys a better relationship, because most of those recommendations they're making are mandated. And there are mandates that apply to a lot of the areas that impact riders, and I think if we put some of those issues in our work plan, then we're helping the board and WMATA honor the responsibilities that they already have. And it will help us get better buy-in, I think. And with better communication, I think that the work that we do can better, you know, better impact our, you know, our mission. So we kind of tried to flesh some of that out. And again, this is all just sort of proposed. We had a little bit of a turnaround. And now we want to hear that people like it or don't, or have other suggestions. But we did read all the SWOTs. We did request them. They were redacted. We read the SWOTs. We all had notes from all of our meetings, and we were working to incorporate everyone's input.
Okay. So we will continue this discussion certainly with Christian when he has arrived, but that sounds great. In the meantime, are the questions that we have ones for the RAC, or are they ones that would be best suited to wait until Christian is here? All right. Then go, Joe.
So I thank you so much for creating this, because I'm sure it took a lot of time and effort and energy. I think the communications part is the basic expectation. They should reply within 30 days at least. However, I don't think it goes far enough in the sense that, because sometimes they could just respond, and it's even if we do provide other, you know, parameters, they could still kind of, you know, give a non-responsive response, essentially. I know GAO, the Government Accountability Office, I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with them, but they have a recommendation tracker. I think it'd be interesting if we could adopt a more discreet, that type of, like, we could always send out reports and memoranda and then label each of them by the year or the actual memoranda number. But in terms of breaking within the memoranda, discrete recommendations for, you know, what they are, and see if based on a tracking system of closed, implemented, closed, not implemented, open, recommendation, like nothing's been done with it, open, priority, I feel like that gives us a more clear understanding. And if all of this is posted on our RAC website that we may or may not have control over, but I would push for a control over, and they can negotiate it out, I think that provides a level of transparency that the riders have not received to this point. And so, and another thing about communications is also the RAC comments email. I think we should have direct access to that so that we could directly see what the riders are or are not saying, or any organizations. I think in general, we should have more of that type of autonomy. If we're not going to get full autonomy, we should at least have co-ownership of it so that we could at least see for ourselves. Thank you.
Deb?
Just to address to what you guys were talking about, thanks for putting it all together. I know we all pretty well respect each other, and there's some agrees to disagrees, and we've always worked through those. I think this is something that will probably be one of those times. I have brought this, is it? We've been to, okay. I've brought this up probably once every 6 months. And every time I bring it up, everybody goes, yeah, 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 and then we kind of fall away from it. We are not a writer's advocacy group. We were not set up to be one. We were appointed by the board to advise the board on things that we see, because we are the writers. If we were a writer's advocacy group, Catherine would be reporting to a group of writers who had to, you know, appointed us. She would be writing memos to them. We are not a writer's advisory group. We are, in a sense, we're employees of the board. The board appointed us to work for them on their behalf and get information to them that we see out and about. And might sound like I'm splitting out hairs, but I'm kind of really not, because not you guys so much what you're just saying now, but what has come through with some of the emails in the past few months, it seems like people think, oh, you know, we're not going to have a writer's advocacy group, and that's kind of what came through in the Post article and some other things. So along that line, what you guys were mentioning about reducing the jurisdictional requirements, you know, six from here, or whatever, my concern with, I understand where it's heading, but again, if we have, we don't have eyes in Fairfax and Tysons and Columbia Pike and Montgomery and Prince's, if we don't have eyes out there, we won't have a broad scope of impact to advise the board. And if all of a sudden we're loaded with DC people, I mean, I understand the goal you're trying to reach, and so maybe there's a third way to reach that as far as you're concerned about how that turnover and everything affects and how we can balance that. That's a concern. But if all of a sudden we have, let's say they decide the size of the rack is 15, and all of a sudden we have 8 DC people and only one person in Northern Virginia, then we've lost the effectiveness of the visibility of what's going on, because one of the most recent things was when they were making these bus changes was the loss of local service. Well, if there weren't people out there in the local, they wouldn't have known where that was going. So you're on the right track, but maybe there's some other way. And lastly, and then I'll stop, is that when we were talking about, well, what if there's people who want to join the RAC, and they really would be great, but they're from D.C. and we're blocked because we don't have that opening. Remember, they're getting 500 applications per recruitment. So with that, I'm sure there's plenty of people to fill the different spots.
On the staffing, if you, it's something you brought up many times, or not several times. If do you want to draft something and we can add it? Yeah. Or if anyone else, I mean, anyone else here, please. I mean, there's, I don't think any one of the three of us has any special powers or anything like that. But if you want to draft something and, you know, we can add it, as long as Catherine's okay with that, then.
For expediency purposes, it might be best to just bring it up tonight in the discussion. Say that while we're having this discussion with Christian, worth bringing some of these extra points up.
The only thing I have. Document viewed by the board as the final document? I'm sorry?
I mean, if it was sent to the board, it was, right?
Yes.
Then, I don't,
when you say final, I don't know that they think it's worth things that they
have. Yeah, I guess what I'm suggesting is,
from the rack.
I think anything that, in this conversation, that comes up, not just my point of view, everybody's point of view, that might add to this or diverge from this or come from a different perspective, I think needs to be in writing and say, you know, at our last meeting, we had further discussion about some of these issues, and here's an addendum to the recommendations.
Can I respond? I just want to say, I definitely thought that we looked at this as a process, and the board asked us to provide something before the board meeting because they've been pushed to have something quick. And I would never call that document a final document. I spoke with Catherine about how it was a little difficult for us to draft something in a vacuum without the entire rack. So I'll just tell the board right now that's not a final document. And I'm happy to make modifications and send it around because we have the absolute power to say these are our modified recommendations because we were told that it was a process. And I can't imagine that we can be, you know, set in stone. I think it's a process and a conversation.
Right.
And I think that there are a lot of issues like the jurisdictional thing that we definitely need to discuss together and with our partners at the board. So I just don't think that we're going to be able to, you know, have a one-size-fits-all resolution overnight. But, I mean, the conversations are helpful.
It's a perception. I think it's a perception issue at this point. I think there may be a perception. We could ask Christian that whether this is our...
Dun, dun, dun. Handy. Given who just walked in the room, that would be handy. By all means. Feel free to load up on cookies, pretzels, cheese, whatever's over there, and join us.
Can I make a point real quick? Please tell me if I'm wrong, anyone else, but the jurisdictional thing is the jurisdictional, like the local jurisdictional guidelines are not in the bylaws. Am I correct on that? Like certain number of people from Arlington, certain people from Arlington, Montgomery, Prince George's, is that, if that's not, I don't know if that's in there. Exactly. So that's why, if you look at the draft, if you look at the exact language, it was it was not in the bylaws. I think I noted in this draft document that it was like a guideline or a tradition, I think, and it's not in the bylaws. Please tell me if I'm wrong, but I did not see a local jurisdictional quota in the bylaws as they are now.
I mean, in Article 3, like membership, competition, correct? Like, maybe not to the level of kind of there's a two or three
county. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, just in terms of three.
That's exactly right.
Well, Christian?
But I just wanted to make a point.
So, as you likely know, we had a subgroup of ourselves put together this series of recommendations, and in the last few minutes, we have just been reviewing those recommendations with the full group, because this is the first time the full group has been together. So, I will start by asking you to give us any updates you've got on what you've been up to on your end once since you've gotten our recommendations and any thoughts you have on them or recommendations you're going to throw back at us. And then we'll open it up to discussion so everybody can bring up their points.
Well, thank you, Chair Cordham, and it's good to be with you all again. So it's good to be with you all, and thank you for the opportunity to bring good greetings from my task force, which includes Paul Smedberg and Kathy Porter. As you all know, we've been working on how to better deal with all of the issues that we've unearthed over the last few months in terms of recruitment and retention for the RAC, making sure that there is adequate communication between the RAC and the board, and making sure you all feel that this is a fulfilling and worthwhile endeavor. So we did receive your recommendations, and we have had a couple of meetings where we've brainstormed and kicked around what are some of our ideas on how to move forward. And we haven't reached any definitive conclusions, but I want to do sort of outline kind of what we're thinking at this point. The major areas, one, we very much appreciate your efforts to streamline committees and align them more with the way the board operates. We really concur with that, and we think that that's a great way to move forward. And what you've identified, combining budget, finance and budget, along with capital projects, we think is a great way to do it. So that makes a lot of sense to us. Then we also have, as part of the board's committees, a safety and service delivery, which encompasses both the technical safety component and then general operations. So we're kind of thinking that it would be great to align that with the RAC as well and having kind of a committee that deals with customer service, safety, and actual transit service issues. And then another thing that we're very much interested in is seeing that part of the charge of the RAC to really be a conduit to greater public participation in the wider rider community, we want to figure out how to make that work. So one of the ideas that we haven't quite figured out how to articulate it, but what we'd like to bring to you is the notion of some formal public participation component. We're really not at a place where we want to recommend that you do it through a separate committee, whether it be the leadership or executive committee of the RAC or whether it be a committee of the whole. You know, I think that merits further discussion, but we would love to see a formal way for that public participation component to be manifest in your work. Other areas that we talked about, certainly size of the RAC, and what we're interested in is really getting away from the whole idea that, and I think I'm picking up on where your conversation last was, that we prioritize narrow jurisdictional participation. What we're really interested in for the RAC is making sure that it reflects all of the different ways people use WMATA Transit. And certainly it's going to have a geographic representation across Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. But to the extent that we prioritize, you're the Alexandria seat, you're the Arlington seat, versus how you actually use transit, we want this body to reflect all of the many ways people use it. Rush hour rail, rush hour bus, off-peak rail and bus, paratransit, multimodal, people who bring lots of different transit experiences, people who pay out of their own dime, people who are not as price sensitive because they're doing some sort of, other connection like smart benefits or heck, you could even think about, people who are part of the UPass program. I'm just making stuff up at this point. But we really want this to be a body that reflects all of the many diversities that people bring to transit ridership in our region. And so that's going to be, something that we're going to propose more formally to you, how to actually do that. And then, of course, the other key concern was how we deal with the resource issue. I want to be very clear. There is not the appetite, and I don't know if you've been following the legislative conversations in Maryland and Virginia, there is not the appetite or, quite frankly, a way forward to bring more staff resources to WMATA that would be devoted to the RAC. Just to give you the basic confines of what we're working with, there is an agreement, and it will be more than likely enshrined in legislative language in both Annapolis and Richmond that there will be a financial penalty if, in fact, the subsidies from the jurisdictions to WMATA exceed 3 percentage point increases year over year. So that's just not going to happen. We're not going to do that because the financial penalty is too big. So with that, we are likely going to look at a scenario that doesn't increase FTEs that are devoted to this effort. So given that we are going to be dealing with existing FTEs, the question is how we make that work. And part of the idea that we're thinking about is kind of what we do at the board level, suggesting that we have designated times for RAC meetings and then, you know, other days for committee meetings, and that they're structured in such a way that it does not create multiple days within a month where we would have to have staff devoted to the effort. So we're looking for efficiency in that regard. But then there's also another key reason, and another key thing that we're very much interested in is making sure that formal communication between the RAC and the board actually happens. And you had some ideas about, mandating responses within, a certain number of days. And while that may be a useful way forward, we think it's also pretty important that the board designate liaisons to actually communicate with the RAC more frequently than just simply you all pinging us with something and our pinging you back. So if we're going to have board liaisons, which is what I think we're going to recommend, we also want those liaisons to actively participate as needed in RAC meetings, for example. So we're looking at a frequency that is manageable to make that possible so that we could actually have a board liaison or a number of liaisons who can actually participate in RAC committees, come to full RAC meetings so that we can ensure that things that you're thinking about, questions that you may ask, work that you're interested in can have a timely and clear avenue for consideration. And we really want that to happen. And the other consideration for us is size, communication, frequency of meetings. There's one other area that I wanted to mention, and it is escaping me at this point. In terms of work plans. So we very much talked about making sure that there is a collaborative approach to an annual work plan that we can sort of adopt at the beginning of the year, but that then it's formally reviewed quarterly so that we can look at the upcoming agenda that the board is going to be offering. We can have a discussion with the RAC about how that might align with issues that you would consider and creating a schedule from when you would provide recommendations so that we can, again, get out of the business of only thinking about it after the fact. Oh, it would have been great for the RAC to have provided comment on that. Or, wouldn't it have been nice if we had known their recommendation before we actually got to the point where we're formally adopting it at the board level. So, in essence, what we're interested in, board liaisons to the RAC, a meeting frequency that enables board members who are those liaisons to participate in better communications, that we look at the RAC membership not jurisdictionally primarily, but by transit mode usage, and that geography of origin be a secondary consideration. And we'll probably, I think at this point, put something on paper, since you all were kind enough to do the same, just to have you noodle over. But we fully read and digested everything that you said, and that's where we are at this point.
Phone might be smarter than me. Do you have a timeline on when you might be providing us with something in writing?
Yes. I think our timeline is to be able to give you something concrete by the time we meet next on April 12th. Is that right, John? Did we discuss that? Okay. Okay. So on or about April 12th is when we would have something. I think that might be right. We're probably going to take what the three of us come with, and we're going to socialize it a little bit more with the Business Oversight Committee just to get the head nod before we maybe then put it out to you all. So that's right. Thank you, John.
Okay. Now, I'm a little surprised that nobody's got a name tag up for question purposes. I figured they might all have been up by now. Thank you for appeasing me there, Colin.
For WMATA, yeah, it's pretty short.
Well, yeah, I mean, for honestly, for many people.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on the question of the jurisdictional, you know, representation. I actually think right before Mr. Dorsey walked in, Paul was making a point about the bylaws, which I think is an important one. In that, I guess, in response to, you know, to Bob's concern. Which is that currently we don't have a formal requirement for each of the county and you know sort of micro jurisdictions, if you will, to be represented. And I do think that your guys' suggestion to operationalize something that allows a little more flexibility makes a lot of sense. I also think your suggestion to make sure that we're representing all of the ways in which people use the system makes heck of a lot of sense. So while I understand your concern, Bob, and making sure that you know the different areas that are impacted by Metro are represented, I think I'm inclined to lean towards the recommendations of the board and the working group on this.
They're doing well. Thank you. Thank you. All right. That's right. I didn't tell them that this is where I was coming tonight.
Oh. Right. We probably had pretty good snacks. They want to come.
It's true.
So I was trying to get my calendar out here. So if you get us something by the middle of April, then when we would have time to see it would be, to talk about it as a whole, would be in May.
Okay.
And we put off elections and selections of things. So I'm just trying to get a feeling of how you're going to operationalize this. Are you thinking that after May there'll be an opportunity for folks to sign on again, or are you going to have a re-selection of the folks? How do you see this working? Because we've got work to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, we haven't gotten to the point where we've actually really tangibly discussed that. So this is just simply my own opinion, and I'll be sure that we flag that when we raise it again. You know, the RAC that we have is the RAC that I think we should continue to have, regardless of what we come up with. So, you know, even if we recommend and you all agree to a number that's different than what the number is right now, That's not going to precipitate an immediate removal of somebody from the RAC. We'll let natural attrition get us to the level that we desire. No. You know, we haven't discussed that, but by no means is that anyone's interest. It's really, you know, that will be something that will be the RAC that we construct moving forward, and then people who want to continue to serve and who are serving well, we want to have continue to serve.
So maybe June or thereafter.
Uh-huh.
And then we would expect that the rest of the calendar year we would do our business and those work plans.
Absolutely.
And then they'll come a new year with new people on the ground.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Great. I'm just trying to figure out
what's happening. No, that's a perfect question, and we haven't discussed that at all, so I will make sure we we get there. That's my thinking. It seems to me to be sound thinking, but, you know, again, it's only mine at this point.
I just wanted to make a comment on the jurisdictions. This is my recollection when I was first appointed, the conversation that I had with then board member Zimmerman. And the way that it was explained to me, it was that apparently, and I don't know how the decisions were made, and there was nothing on paper, mind you, but that what they were doing internally, for appointment purposes, was that they, the Maryland jurisdictions got, they had decided on 6 members per jurisdiction, and then they added the at-large after the fact, okay? And then the 6 Maryland, the 6 PG County and Montgomery County, they figured split 3 and 3. Mm-hmm. In Virginia, there was a difference, and so they went by the number of stations that they had in the jurisdiction. Okay. So Alexandria had the 1 member. Arlington had 2, and Fairfax had the 3 to make the 6. That was how Mr. Zimmerman explained that they were doing, and he personally had decided that he wanted to have 1 person from North Arlington and 1 person from South Arlington, mm-hmm. because there were differences in ridership patterns, because North Arlington has a whole lot of metro stations, South Arlington has only 2. So we have to take, when I say 2-2, to serve residents. So we have to take a lot of buses to take us to Metro, and there's no parking in any of the stations. So all those things were apparently taken into consideration, you know, and mind you, at the time, they were still under a lot of stations under construction, and that, since, you know, a lot of questions have been asked about it, that's the way it was explained to me. I think that I am the most senior here then, mm-hmm. and that was the explanation that was given to me at the time. So just wanted to add the 2 cents worth.
I appreciate that, Lorraine. I mean, one of the things I'm not doubting your recollection at all, but I'm then skewed by the numbers, and you know, I know Chris well, and he's a smart guy, but Arlington had more stations than any other Virginia jurisdiction up until Silver Line Phase 2. So. Yeah. Yeah, but I got a bone to pick with him. He gave up Arlington seats under that old regime. That's ridiculous. But I think, you know, the spirit of what you're saying is very much reflected in what we're going to recommend. It's looking at the different ways you use transit. So, and it's not just North or South Arlington or Arlington and Fairfax. I got to be honest, if you are getting on the Orange Line at Vienna and traveling to Farragut West, getting on at Ballston and traveling to Farragut West, I'm not really sure, you know, I got to preserve different seats for that kind of transit experience. But people who bus to rail, that's a meaningful difference versus people who walk to rail because they're, you know, in a building above a metro station. Or drive to a station. You know, those are all of the things that I think would make for a better considered RAC membership than just simply a geographic space. Because whatever Mr. Zimmerman's considerations might have been, those were not enshrined in any policy document. So, you know, that's the thoughtfulness that went into his approach, I think, is what we'd like to bring overall. And, you know, sometimes the jurisdictional seats per se may limit that creativity a bit. So.
Yeah. So my current understanding is that at the recruitment level, when the applications are out, all of that, is that not currently considered at that stage? Or, like, I'm curious what, if the board is looking to enshrine that into the bylaws, in what way would that look like? I'm just curious.
Well, I think we enshrine it by sort of putting it into the charge for the RAC and then having that be clear guidance for consideration. So it'll help staff in terms of recruitment and who they offer to the RAC for recommended membership, and then ultimately it's approved by the board members for those jurisdictions. Right now, there's really not a whole lot of guidance other than you meet the criteria, you have something to offer, and you are from the slot, right? So that's pretty much how it happens. So this, I think, will make it possible to actually look at a pool of candidates and say, wow, you know, this person brings something that we don't have. And, you know, and one of the ways to do it is by preserving the at-large and jurisdictional structure. So we are looking to do that as well.
Just to piggyback on what you were saying there about, you know, the people that bus to rail and drive to rail, walk to rail, those all represent kind of different patterns that you want to look at. Beg you to not forget people that never use the train. There are people that use the bus and bus only, and
absolutely,
I think they get lost in the translation so much. Right now, one of my biggest heartaches right now is the decisions that are being made on the Columbia Pike Corridor. Only folks down at the Pentagon Metro Station were surveyed. And there are people that pick that bus up at Glebe and go out to Bailey's and back or Colmore, and they never see the light of day at a metro station, so they were left completely out of the loop. So these guys know I'm always like, don't forget the bus riders.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Obviously, I think we want to think about doing this in a way that doesn't impede our access to the wider board membership at large.
Mm-hmm.
And we
mm-hmm.
still want to maintain close relationships. But personally, I'm a big fan. I'm curious to hear what other people think. My second point in question is, you know, when you're talking about work plans, you said the occasion frequently comes up when you think, wouldn't it be nice for, you realize it would have been nice for the
mm-hmm.
RAC to have the opportunity to comment on this or to give us their feedback. And I guess the proposal that we had in mind to try to address that was to sort of norm that whenever the board votes on anything non-emergency related that has to do with riders, right,
mm-hmm.
whether it's fare and budget policies, customer service, you know, bus changes, that automatically that go before the RAC, you know, with some sort of grace period of maybe 1 or 2 weeks' notice,
mm-hmm.
so that we have the opportunity to comment. And that way the board will never have, you know, another vote without some sort of RAC input. What do you think that's
spirit-wise, we're in complete agreement. Operationally, as we discuss this, we realize it's not as easy to implement. That's not to say that we have been going to disregard it as a goal, but we're very reluctant to, from a governance perspective, require that board consideration only occur after the RAC has had an opportunity to consider, because there will be times where that's just not feasible or desired for whatever reason. Here are some of the just immediate examples that come to mind. For example, the conversation we're about to have on whatever date this month about making permanent the U-Pass program. I'm not sure that we've had a formal recommendation from the RAC on that. That's something that we could have had a recommendation from the RAC on, because, you know, we're talking about a program that went from, you know, pilot, review, and then a recommendation for final. And I think it would have been, I mean, this is a significant change, I think a positive one generally. I'm sure you probably would have looked at it the same way. However, it is a significant change in the fare offerings that we have. And I think certainly it would have been wonderful that we had the Riders Advisory Council be able to, you know, give us a recommendation and some feedback on that issue. Could have very easily been achieved, and I think that's the kind of thing that I'm looking to see happens. You know, how we would have enshrined that, that's what we're noodling over, how to make that work. But that's the spirit of what we're aiming for. Yeah, definitely.
as Vermont is a place where which you're seeing decreasing ridership, mm-hmm. is part of looking to building up a new route of WIP, and kind of like also people who hate alternative modes of transportation in addition to metro, just because that is a perspective that you want to have, like, into being like, okay, well, you know, for example, I take the metro in the morning to do Vanderbilt, and then I take Capital Bike Share from DuPont to my campus, and then I bike it all the way home rather than taking the metro to the airport. So we're just trying to get a dynamic to sort of see that the people who are making alternative trains still use the metro. It's a good feedback loop, kind of thinking about, like, how do we potentially get me to take the metro back to work.
It is, and thank you. We hadn't thought about that specifically, but I think that's a great addition that we can think about how to capture during recruitment, because there are many things. There may be people who like those other modes because the time of day they're more reliable or efficacious than at other times, or maybe they're making healthy lifestyle decisions to walk and bike. You know, there are all kinds of things, but if that's not a part of our conversations running a transit agency, I see the real benefit of that. We've been spinning our wheels and figuring out, why are we losing riders? Not that you know we're going to have one or two people on a rack who are going to answer that question definitively, but to you know, offer some constructive thinking that we could wrap our head around, that it really may not be because we're not offering a great product, but maybe the world in which people move has really shifted a little bit, and we ought to think about how we adapt to that world versus figuring out how we capture it back, which is kind of always the conversation. How do we get them back? Well, maybe it's not that. How do we introduce maybe more people to adopt that, which provides an incremental addition to WMATA? So that's good.
Okay, well then I will use it. Thanks for having this conversation with us. I just want to emphasize that those of us that drafted these recommendations, we did so without having the opportunity to consult with our entire colleagues on the RAC. We were really wanting to get something to you guys before the board meeting. And as eager as we are to get back to work in our committees, and I really mean, I think we are very eager to do so, I would really appreciate the opportunity to have time to see what you guys put in writing, and also to incorporate some of the other insights from our colleagues that we discussed before you came, and some other things that, you know, we'll probably have some ideas after we, you know, mull over this conversation as well. So I hope that, you know, we see this as a process. You know, this is not a final set of recommendations, and, you know, we just want to move forward and get something soon so we can get back to work. Thanks.
Happy to connect, Chair Cordom, with you afterwards to figure out other ideas that I could then make sure we don't lose time in noodling over, so that we can then keep this momentum in the process. Thank you, Rebecca, moving forward pretty quickly. But thank you all very, very much, and appreciate your accommodating. I know that I originally asked to come at the end of the meeting and then had to change that to the beginning, so I really do appreciate your accommodating me.
We appreciate your coming and talking to us. We are very enthusiastic when we thank people.
I'm on a sugar high.
All right, this will get good then. All right, well, as we go through the agenda, I realize that we approved the agenda, and then I promptly deviated by it by completely skipping the approval of the minutes, which was unintentional, but we can approve those minutes now if anybody wants to make a motion, and if anybody else would happen to want to second that motion.
But I also want to note that John really went out of his way to capture.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is amazing.
Well done.
I second the motion.
Okay. Any adjustments needed to the minutes, or it's hard to make adjustments to the thoroughness of these. All in favor of approving the minutes? Any opposition? Any abstentions? One abstention. Okay. Thank you, John, for providing us with a novelette that summarized our wild and crazy meeting. Not so wild, not so crazy, I suppose, but for very thoroughly capturing it. Okay. I do want to potentially reopen the public comment period if any members of the public do want to speak to us. They are welcome to do so. Absolutely no requirement to do so. But, okay. Then I will turn it over to Shelley. I assume you're Shelley, sitting back there, to talk to us about Red Line Turnbacks, or Red Line Service Grosvenor Turnbacks.
There you go, good light on.
Okay. Okay, good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. So I'm here to present to you the alternatives for the additional rail line service, which is... Okay, now I got it. Now it's too loud, probably. Okay, so I'm here to present the alternatives for additional red line service, which is the regarding the Grosvenor Turnback proposal. So this presentation is, the purpose is to inform the board and also, I guess, inform everyone the alternatives to increasing the red line weekday peak service between Shady Grove and White Flame. And so there's four stations in that segment, Shady Grove, Rockville, Twin Brook, and White Flame. And this is the alternative is based on the review by the directive for the board resolution. I think it's 2015-37, so it's based on. Next. So give you some background about, so this is our current peak service for Red Line. We operate like two service patterns during the peak between Shady Grove and Glamon and between Grosvenor and Silver Spring. So during the peak time, under current 8 minutes headway, between Shady Grove and Twin Brook, we operate every 8 minutes or about 7.5 or 7 to 8 trips per hour. But south of Grosvenor to downtown, we pretty much have double service. We have 15 trains per hour running about 4 minutes headway between Grosvenor and Silver Spring. On the other time, we basically running the 12 minutes headway on the off peak, and the late night is 20 minutes headway. So the next slide gives you a little bit of background and the history about what kind of service we provided to that segment of the Red Line. From opening of the segment to 2004, we operated during the peak time, it's a 6 minutes headway or about 10 trains an hour. South of Grosvenor, of course, is always double between Grosvenor and downtown. And then after April 2004 and between June 2010, we increased the headway to 5 minutes, which is running 12 minutes and 12 trains out of Shady Grove. And then during that time, we really actually struggled to deliver 5 minutes headway on the red line. I guess a lot of you probably experienced. Part of the reason is actually I think in late 2004, we opened a NOMA station and actually increased the running time required. And also during, I think, the boom time, we have lots of ridership and really require more dwell time during the downtown station. So the several factors really impacted our service reliability. And also after the 2009 accident, we are putting on the manual mode that also really put us in a really difficult time to deliver that many trains. So by the June 2010, we really adjusted running time for the red line, and we went back to the 6 minutes headway. And then the service really improved quite a bit, but still we have a lot of track work and other reason to decrease the service. So as part of the overall system evaluation on the performance and also service reliability, last year we improved the running time for all the service lines on our system, and we put the decreased frequency a little bit to the 8 minutes headway to improve our service reliability. And since then, actually, the red line's on-time performance, which is scheduling schedule adherence, actually improved to 92% now. Actually, it's quite an improvement from comparing with before. We are in the low 80s. So, yeah. So the next slide will present you the three service alternatives based on the board resolution direction. It's fully eliminating the Grosvenor turnback. That means running every trans out of Shady Grove. Then that would be running the 15 trains out of Shady Grove. So maybe you remember the previous slide we saw. We never ever run 15 trains out of one terminal at the Shady Grove terminal. The most we run is 12 trains. So that's the reason we proposed the middle plan B, which is the eliminating the partial turnback. Then there will be operating 12 trains out of the Shady Grove station, still operating half of the short trips out of the Grosvenor. Of course, the last one will be the no change, keep the status quo as now. So so that's the three options we put out. So the next two slides actually show you some of the realities for turning the train, in Shady Grove or Grosvenor. So this slide showing you the current situation. Basically, we're running every 8 minutes headway to Shady Grove, so we leave the spacing over there. It's much easier to turn the train at more frequent trains at the Grosvenor. Then you will have a spacing at Shady Grove to move the train back in and out. So next slide will show you. Oh, you have a question? Go back. Okay. All right. So, all right. So, I'm sorry. So, the 101 is basically the indicating the red blocks is the train. Okay, indicating the train going through the each station. The white block is the Rockville station. The next station is Shady Grove. Right. The two lines representing the track. Track one, the track two, and the red and the green dots representing the signal.
Okay? So you see the trans has to move, has to have some spacing between the trains in order to get in the train in and out of station quickly. Otherwise, you will have some kind of congestion. If you look the next page, you will see if we are doing like a 15 minutes, 15 trains per hour, we'll have a high percentage coming out of this situation. You have two trains occupied, the two platforms at Rockville, and you also have two trains occupied at Shady Grove. So leaving the train 156 have no way to turn. So you have to wait to move 160 out of the station of Rockville, and then move maybe either one of the 000 or 166 out of the Shady Grove in order to putting the 156 into the platform. So that's why more trains sometimes can create a terminal congestion and is will impacting the service reliability down the road. So that's the reason we try to simulate and show you in these two slides. Can be really, so if it's a 15 minutes per train, per each direction. You talk about a 15 trains coming in and 15 trains going out, right? So it's really frequent. And then you have to be really on time for each train to schedule. If it's not, if any trains like delay, you have some incident down the road, you will make in these congestions.
So
it can happen really quickly.
To make sure I understand, then, if you go back one slide and look at the diagram for White, Flint, and Grosvenor,
yes,
the reason that there would be less congestion by having more trains there is that there's the siding in between Grosvenor and White, Flint, where the trains can basically get out of the way.
We have a pocket track, like the 821 is the pocket track. So we can slide in the additional trains. If it's congested, we can slide in there to clear the track to go through, to let the train go through, and then make the trains deliver. So they have more space to turn the trip. Yeah.
So I thought this is very interesting. And
yeah,
the first question I thought of is, yeah, what about the people? How many people do you have getting on at Shady Grove? How many people do you have getting on at Rockville? Yeah. What's the timing of the people?
The timing of the people, actually, in terms of the yeah, we looked at the ridership. It is getting, well, of course, a lot of people getting in the Shady Grove. It's our heavy, really heavy station, one of the heavy stations. But it's not that congested, so everyone will cram, right? So the people will have, most of the people have a seat in the first station. Of course, when you get to the White Flint, maybe you get a little bit congested. You may maybe not having a seat. That's why, I mean, one of the things giving the turn back in the Grosvenor, you gave people in Grosvenor and Medical Center have some chance to get some better service. Yeah. So. Well, yes. Well, part of that, we try to provide the service to downtown area because a lot of people from that segment and going down to the downtown area. So our max low point actually is at the DuPont Circle. So most of people, after DuPont Circle, getting more people get off, right? So between Shady Grove and DuPont Circle, of course, you have more people getting on. So in order to release the service demand, so we added the service. But as we mentioned before, we want to have provided better service, so we turn back with the station have a tail track, have a pocket track, so we can have a reliable service, and that's the reason.
But that's the major reason for the status quo.
Yeah, yes.
Congestion of passengers on track.
Yeah, red line it is,
yeah.
So in order to provide like a double service, which is
for most of the lines, we're running 8 minutes headway, right? But the red line, effectively from Grosvenor to Silver Spring, we're running 4 minutes headway.
So why, what is the impetus for change?
I don't have too much history about this, but I just know this is really directed by the board resolution 2015-37. Yeah, board resolution. Yeah, it's a board resolution. I guess, I don't know. John, do you have any? I think, I don't know too much history about the board discussion, but I think it's the, Montgomery County probably requested. I think that's the. At the board resolution? I saw.
So this was agreed to, or this was inserted in the resolution as part of funding for, I think, additional rail cars as well as some infrastructure improvements to allow all 8-car trains. That then there was an agreement that Metro would end the Grosvenor turnback, and so. Under the board resolution, it stated that it would, you know, Metro would do, you know, undertake whatever, you know, whatever is needed to ensure that the service, the additional service, would be in place and operating by July 1 of 2018. And I think some of the concern was that we're obviously not, you know, we're in the exploratory stage, and as you'll see when Shelley gets to the timeline, that while there may be a decision at that point, the implementation will probably be some more months away.
Yeah.
The resolution states, and I can't pull it up, but I can email it to you. It
yeah,
it was the elimination of the Grosvenor turnback.
Yeah.
Basically, in return for paying for power upgrades on the Virginia lines, Maryland said, we'll agree to pay for it, but you have to promise us that by July 1, 2018, we get full service back on the Shady Grove end of the Red Line. Well, elimination of the turnbacks, so that... Yeah, I guess... Okay, so the next page will... That's why for that, I guess for that purpose, the staff is doing additional analysis, which is twofold, right? One is the one I mentioned a little bit earlier, is like what's the operational reliability is, and so we look the terminal operation, we looked how the OCC control, because and also how the yard, because the Shady Grove station actually is right next to the yard, okay? And then there's no pocket track behind that. So it's also maybe impacting the yard operation. So that's why, and we're also looking like, because of the added service, we need to add the staffing and then also training. And so that's on the operation side. On the infrastructure side, we also doing the engineering evaluation on the interlocking, because the interlocking at the Shady Grove is relatively old interlocking, and like I mentioned before, they never ever really operated like 15 trains in and out of the station from that terminal. The only one with much newer interlocking is like Greenbelt and Lago, which is we're running the 15 trains an hour before when we're running the Rush Class service. So that's the several things we're working there. We're also looking into increased service, maybe increased ridership, maybe impacting the vertical movement over there. So to see if we'll identify any issues with any vertical movement and maybe needed to
necessary to add a staircase or stairway to improve the passenger flow. So those are the few things we are looking at those and then try to identify any improvements is needed for the future capital improvement. So next. So this is our, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, that's part of the timeline. So we do present it to the board and to you guys right now. And then in the meanwhile, we're developing outreach material during this month, and we will conducting the public input and then comment period later this month and in May. And then from actually starting now and then until June, we're doing the full complete Title VI equity analysis. I think based on the resolution, they wanted to, yeah. Of course. That would be, I guess, okay. Yeah. We're still evaluating. That's why that's a part of the analysis we have to do. We have to look the operational impact, look for the infrastructure. If infrastructure doesn't support that, what kind of the improvement need to be done to in order to deliver that kind of service? So that's all kind of the analysis is doing right now. And that's why we're going to report back to the board in July with the costing, with the funding, with the full report on the Title VI analysis. Yeah, that's the timeline. That's why we are working a lot of this material right now. So next. The next step is, like I mentioned, is we will return to the board in July with all these results. Based on the board's decision, and we will present this to also to the finance committee for FY19 amendment on the budget. And if they approve, of course, we need to schedule this and then put it into like a union pick, and then we needed to do all this public information. And I think the earliest we can implement, I think, is December 2018. So, with that, any questions? I guess this is the last. Yeah.
Okay. And as an FYI, staff have previously reported that the cost to do this would be an additional $1.25 to $1.75 million per year to go to full service. So going through the list here, Colin, I think I've got you first.
So, I mean, part of me certainly feels that if the board agreed to do this, then, you know, they kind of have to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
But I guess more importantly, I think this speaks to sort of the system's capacity as a whole to provide, you know, timely and reliable service, and I think you noted a couple of factors that have inhibited that to date, including, you know, infrastructure, obviously, the rail car reliability, manual train control, and, you know, quality of operations in the operations center itself.
Yes.
And I think this probably is fairly analogous to examples like, you know, previous reductions in Blue Line service and the turnback that currently exists on the Yellow Line at Archives, or Mount Vernon, sorry. So I guess all of that is to say, can you speak more broadly to the efforts underway to improve the reliability of operations in general so that perhaps in the future we can not only see, you know, this restoration of service, but, you know, perhaps an increase in service since the reduction of service overall to the point where right now we have, you know, 8-minute headways as of relatively recently.
Yeah, we as part of the effort, actually, we do monitoring like passenger load, and so at the max low point to really evaluating how crowding is, and like for example, as after the last June, we operating the new 8-minute highway, and then we recognize like yellow and green is really crowded during the peak. We added more A-car trains on yellow and green. And I don't know if you guys notice, yellow was supposed to be not running any A-cars, but now we're running a few A-cars. Good. So that's kind of the improvement we gradually add into the service. We monitoring, like right now, based on our ride check, basically the passenger check, we didn't see a lot of crowding in the other lines. So that's why we are focused on improving the yellow and the green right now. And then probably we're looking for next maybe to see the red line to see if we can have some other room to improve. Because the red line is the next, it's pretty crowded. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Are they all 8-car trains on the red line now?
No, it's about 50%.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not all the lines. Well, that's why we try to do this operational analysis and the infrastructure analysis to presenting those information to the board and the staff to give them some information so they can make a good decision, yeah. Hopefully. So. Well, the demand definitely not that high right now. I mean, it's based on the 8-minute highway, we're still under our service guideline. So definitely not like over like 100 per car in that section. It is crowded, but not that crowded. And so that's the reason we propose the alternative B, which is can, if possible, can just turn half of that over there. So that's the reason we presented that option.
Thank you for coming,
Heather,
right?
Okay, yes.
Oh, yeah. I got a question on slide number, it's page, can you go back? That one right there.
Okay.
Does train number 166 have to use the interlocking to the left of Shady Grove, or could it just turn around?
Yeah. So if 166, well, he's coming into the 166, right?
He's at Shady Grove right now.
Yeah. So when he's ready and he can cross to going out.
Okay, so he doesn't need to use the interlocking to the left of Shady Grove.
No, he he will not using the back interlocking, but he has to use the front interlocking.
So he's going. So he doesn't have to use the back interlocking. Obviously, he has to use an interlocking, or he's going down the wrong track. But he doesn't have to use the interlocking to the left. He could just go to the right, use the interlocking to the right, and then go to Rockville.
That's right. So he has to come.
So he's got. Okay. So he's not going to flip around in the to the left of that.
It always
goes back up. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so he doesn't use that interlock. So the interlock doesn't, it's not really relevant. Okay. Right?
Yeah. Well, if it's really congested,
the reason this is important is because this saves time if you can get these trains out of here faster. Okay, so he could get out of there faster. Okay, good. So that is more difficult. Who gives the discretion on doing that? Is that the LCC says, okay, you got to do plan B versus plan A or whatever? Okay. And the other question is, what would happen on the other side of the red line with the Glenmont Silver Spring action? Would, first of all, political consideration, would people on eastern Montgomery County say, well, now we want our trains to go all the way to Glenmont? And also your infrastructure, too.
The Silver Spring is always the turning point at that point.
Okay, so no one's saying on the Eastern County, like, well, why does West County get all the nice stuff and we have to...
Well because the ridership, I guess, is not that high.
It's not there, okay, so we can say that, all right. That's all I got.
All right, Sita?
I thank you for coming.
Okay.
Well, that's the thing. So we try to say we definitely need to improve, like, signaling, and then that's why we do all this evaluation over there to see how likely and how smooth operation can be, because that station, like I mentioned, the cross in the front actually is pretty old cross. It's not. And then, like the history I showed you before, we never operated 15 trains in and out of that terminal before. So there's a lot of things to learn and practice to get to the good service out of, So.
My worry is that if your evaluation shows that, like, the partial elevation, every 5 minutes,
Exactly. So.
Do we know if there's any other possible?
Actually, no, because the Grosvenor is really have a really good tail track there and the pocket track. So that's why, that's the reason when we turn in the trains, we usually like to turn at especially at the high frequency, and that's the reason during the peak. We don't turn yellow at Fort Totten because Fort Totten doesn't have a pocket track. Yeah, that's the reason. Even though the demand is really there because of, like, U Street and then Georgia Avenue area actually is really have high demand, but it's just we can't, fiscally we can't turn trains over there.
Joe.
Yeah, so are you
8-car trains for the partial elimination, or is there any way to make the trains more higher capacity so when they do turn or when they go to individual stations, you could pick up more people and you can make less turns, but you have more people on the train?
Well, that's as I mentioned earlier, we are evaluating the demands. We try to add more 8-car trains like on the red line next, like we're doing the yellow and green right now. And of course, we're evaluating to see if we can add more 8-car trains before we do this.
My main question also was, so I see that there are three options, but because we did say that we were going to do full elimination of the Grosvenor, like, is there a proposal for just that first, for full elimination, like how we can make that possible or like attainable? Because it seems like the proposal here is just giving us reasons why B or C might be better, but I don't see much, you know, analysis on, you know, for A.
So that's the reason we mentioned later. Mm-hmm. We will adding those analysis in the later to present to the board, say, what's the impact on the full elimination, what's the cost on the full elimination, and then same thing on the plan B, and of course C is just status quo.
And for the A part, when is that coming again? You said, is there like a timeline for when that will be proposed? Because I feel like
it's the same. Either board decided
whatever
to partial
is.
Or to full. Uh-huh. Yeah, we will work on that.
It's just, I mean, if we promise
December,
the polls.
Yeah. It would start happening
yeah,
in December.
Yeah, you'll be a DJ in December.
No, just like, it just seems like the proposals are, one has a lot more emphasis on, yeah, it's obvious. I mean, it's just why, yeah, it's not what we promise, and yeah, we can't keep our promises. If anything, we should increase this. I don't know, based on the ridership. It seems like there are more riders and people are angry about this, and I don't know. I mean, maybe the data says say differently, but.
The ridership definitely, the Amens Highway can handle. It's definitely not mm-hmm. at the, like, over the threshold. It's not.
Yeah. You didn't mention
it's
that.
Just, but I guess.
But it is crowded, not really crowded, but crowded, yeah. It is. It's only fair.
Okay. This is a part of the operational analysis. Yeah. I haven't gathered the full report yet, but I mean, yeah, it's a part of things we're looking like what's the availability for the parking situation. This anecdotal, I think Shady Grove has pretty full, right? I don't know, but they still have some space in Wifflin, I think, because there's no official parking over there, right? So. Yeah, I know they do, but it's because they pay more. We made the presentation, and then they will, yeah. Well, we present the three alternatives. They need decided on one. I guess when we present, we will give them all the information on each each alternative, and then. No, I can't. I don't. No.
So what happens if Amazon is going to 50,000 employees?
Okay, well, that's, yeah. All right, so
So getting out of the realm of science fiction here. Rebecca.
That I, since I'm not on that high level, I guess I can't answer that question, unfortunately. So, yeah, I guess I will defer to maybe you ask it next time when the board member here. I think you mentioned it before. Yes, it's a one point something.
That's the cost. I don't.
That's all, I guess, based on whatever the funding agreement that we have. So that's, yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? Any other for Shelley?
Thank you. No problem. Yeah. I know. Thank you.
Thank you for getting up front and pointing it all out and demonstrating. That was very helpful. All right, we have one more topic for tonight, and that is, we'll call it national service, or at least the agenda calls it national service. I'll call it event service, major events. Opening it up for discussion. This was something that came up from public comment last time when we had a few baseball fans in particular who were concerned about the All-Star game being here and the lack of service and the fact that that might not look good as we are on the national stage for such a game. That is one event of many that could potentially get extended service. So, Paul, I don't know if you want to start this, given that you were the author of...
Sure. Okay. Does this thing work, by the way, Deborah? Okay. No problem. I just can't hear myself. As Catherine mentioned, this is something from last month when we had two people come and mention various events that were happening in D.C. And I asked if we could draft something quick to the board, just making them aware that these events are going to happen. And I'm pretty sure I called it low hanging fruit because I'm sure the board and Mr. Wiedefeld and WMATA management are very, very well aware that these events are happening and they want these things to go off without a hitch. Initially it looked good, but there was a little bit of pushback. And I think I read some of the emails. I think Clarence had a good email, and I think Colin did, and Lorraine did as well, about some of the optics, some of the budgetary issues, and maybe some of the steps that stems from what Deborah was saying. Are we a writer advocacy group? Are we, I don't like the word employees. That implies that we get paid. Okay, good, because I should, if we get paid to be here, I haven't taken a check for a year, so I'd like that sent to me. Sure, I get it. I get it.
You get paid in cheese.
I do. And... You're great, Clarence. and I think it's a tough issue because, first of all, we've got a policy. I don't even know whether we can call it a policy because, honestly, all I found on it in my research was a couple of news articles saying that individual organizations or individual sponsors for events have to pay have to post a deposit for $100,000 an hour. First of all, that policy, the first thing I got on it, please tell me if I'm wrong, everyone, was from July last year, so this isn't like a long-term tradition of WMATA to require this.
No, you're not wrong. A couple of things. One, just overarching. If you go searching for WMATA policies, that's why you have staff, so please feel free to reach out to me and I can help you look for stuff. But that aside, yes, it is additional hours. What changed in July was the rate. We had been charging, I want to say, don't quote me on this. I want to say it was some absurdly low number, like $30,000 an hour.
Okay.
And that hadn't been adjusted since, you know, like 1984. It had been a long time since we had ratcheted up that number, and, you know, it didn't reflect the growth in the system since we had established the number, and the number of trains and throughput and employees and stations and all that. So what I believe was changed was the per-hour unit cost, but it has been a long-standing tradition for both early opens and late closes to ask for additional payment.
Now, here's something something to kind of ask about that is, it seems to be a way we're treating certain events differently from other events, because you have the big march last 2 weeks ago where, and please tell me if I'm wrong on this one, where we had rush hour service the entire day and there weren't any costs being paid by the march organizers. So it sounds like if this policy is being inconsistently applied among special interests. That's the only difference I can think of, but you're asking for a large additional cost during that entire day providing rush hour service. Now, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I can be asked to say, well, what's the difference between rush hour service all day versus an hour later? I have no idea. I mean, I don't think that's our job to work those numbers. But there is a cost. One cost is being borne by event organizers, and another cost is not. I don't know if that's part of the policy either, and I don't know if it should be.
I guess 2 points there. First, we don't. I mean, this is sort of getting into the weeds. We don't know if the march did or did not put a deposit down, but
they did not.
We know that for sure. Okay.
They did not.
I guess sort of more sort of broadly speaking, though, it's not necessarily the event that ends up paying the bill. The deposit is only to make sure that WMATA's costs are covered. And if an event is
point.
Big enough, and I think that's sort of an appropriate barometer. I think I sort of agree with this idea that, you know, a policy is a policy. And if an event is big enough, the riders will be there to support the costs. Right. And if not, then the organization should be held liable for the difference. It's not that the organization pays the entire cost. It's that we need to make sure there are enough riders so that it's sustainable.
Then
I think that's the idea.
Is that the idea of what the emails were? I don't know if that was the case, because I think there were suggestions that, well, someone go to DC government and ask DC government for that. And I don't know if those are appropriate things for the RAC to be asking.
The sporting event, like WMATA, will continue running up until it would normally close, and any time thereafter is like it just wouldn't be running. So if WMATA decided on its own in the lead up to those hours that we're going to just run this fish on because it's the All-Star Game, because we're at the nation's capital, or what,
right.
Within its own time, it's fine. But after it closes, then I think that it becomes a different issue of it being a subsidy to other people. I don't follow baseball. I don't do all those other things. I ride the Metro. I make adjustments according to my schedule. So then I come back and say, as those members of the public came back and like, well, we need to get home. I need to do this. I'm like, well, that's not really, like, to put that concern, that funding cost on the system, a call for everyone else to do for that. And I think this is also a money-making event for the Nationals, for the All-Star Game, because people want to be there. And so if they want to have people coming there to utilize the system because it's more convenient, I don't think it's inappropriate to sort of say, like, well, then it's on you to make the cost.
Then I would think that I wouldn't want to parse out who's profit, who's not profit, who's the, you know, the power broker coming in from. I think I told Rebecca and Cease about this. Who's the power broker coming in from Vienna riding Metro versus the person that's barely scraping by? I don't care. I don't. I mean, a rider's a rider's a rider. And if a rider says, hey, we would like to have this particular service, I think as the Riders Advisory Council, we should hear them out.
And the other side of the rider who's just like, well, who's the other person who isn't going to that event, who with their same ridership fund that they put in.
You could say that about, we could say that about anything, because I could say, well, why am I subsidizing someone going to Shady Grove? That service that she was, that Shelley was talking about, that's going to cost me money, and I never go to Shady Grove. So we can parse it out all day long. Someone's going to end up making, someone's going to end up coming out ahead than someone else. That's just the way mass transit works.
I had not participated in this conversation very much because, frankly, I think it is wonderful that baseball exists, but I don't think that it's WMATA's problem that there's a late game. And if people doing baseball want to take public transportation, I think that'd be great. So let's have them put some money in the pot and they can do that. But we had last year people who were saying, I need this for my job, and WMATA cut the hours even though they work late at bars. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I would much rather people had jobs and were able to take WMATA than people could go to a baseball game, which I'm sure would be lovely for them and for others. But I just think that it's one of those things. We are in a tight budget situation. I think it sends a wrong message if the RAC sends something to WMATA saying, we want you to spend money on a baseball game, but we don't want you to spend money on people who have to get to work.
Why would the RAC say, we don't want you to spend money on people who get to work?
Well,
where does that conversation happen?
I'm sorry. Let me
rephrase. We're fighting for one and not the other.
We had riders come and say, you know, we don't want you to cut the hours.
I wasn't at that meeting, so I can't. You know, I would have fought tooth and nail for those people too.
Period.
Oh, hang on, Cisa. I've got you next.
I was just going to say.
I'm not a member of the learner organization. I can't help you on that.
I mean, I think either way, I think you guys have said that it is clear. Sorry?
This is your comment, so go for it.
Yeah, that it is clear that there should be a clear mechanism by which if sponsors wanted to pay up the money, $100,000 or whatever, to do it, that they should be able to clearly do so and make it transparent for everyone. I'm just wondering, for these riders who say, I'm willing to pay peak price or maybe even $10, $15, is there a business case there where, you know, if 1,000 people by a certain point, you know, pay $20 to have this operational, then it'll kick in the service, and if not, then it automatically gets refunded to their... Yeah, no, I mean, like, I just think that there is a business... Like, if there are enough people in these high-traffic, like, times to do that, like, I don't see why you can't buy tickets in advance. I think that's a new, novel approach, but I don't know if that's feasible, but I just think that there should be that kind of...
I mean, I guess. I don't know.
And if
know.
Not,
I
there mean, are even honestly, those people out there that are saying, well, I think we should, Metro should name their price. Like, can we do late night service all the time and tell us how much the jurisdiction should pay, name the price, and if they pay it, then you guys should have to pay. You guys should have to offer this service all the time. Because I feel like it should just be more transparent in general. Like, there should be a menu of options, and the price should be named, and if people are willing to pay for that service, then they should get the service. And
keeping our timing in mind, I will go to Colin.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this. Joe, I think you actually raised some interesting points that we should discuss at a future date, but my sense is that we're not going to reach consensus on this, and that we should just go ahead and end discussion. Sorry.
I don't know if that's a motion, Colin, but
it is. Yeah, it's a motion.
All in favor of ending discussion for tonight, given that our committees are on hold, so we have no more discussion on this until the next RAC meeting. All in favor? For tonight. Okay, then we will end this debate for tonight because Colin has an excellent point that in the next minute and a half or so, we are probably not going to come to consensus on this. That extra 90 seconds would have done it. Well, that said, good night, all. Well, with the end of this one, I will consider this meeting adjourned, so be well.